ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This conversation includes content that may be sensitive for some listeners. Please take care when listening.
Dr. Paul Hardesty is an author and an engineer with a deep interest in water. Paul's the former CEO of the Australian Institute of Marine Science, but his path to this world wasn't what you might expect. Paul grew up in Western Canada under the influence of his driven, hard-drinking father. As a younger man, Paul worked as a roughneck, labouring on an oil rig. He went to the Arctic, blowing through ice sheets looking for gold. Then Paul decided to get out of the oil industry. After he got a PhD in hydrology, he was sent to Ghana and Yemen to help people get access to clean drinking water. Paul's also written several novels that were inspired by his work in Africa and the Middle East, and now Australia. And his latest book is a memoir about his time as the CEO of the Australian Institute of Marine Science and the battle to save the Great Barrier Reef. His book is called In Hot Water. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Richard. Thanks so much for having me on the studio.
You grew up in Canada. Which part of Canada are we talking about?
I was born in Toronto in the east, and then we moved to the west in Vancouver. Beautiful part of the world.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've never been to that part of the world. How would you paint a picture of that part of the world where you grew up?
It's a temperate rainforest covering these beautiful mountains, fjord-like if you've been to Norway or that part of the world, with these incredible mountains that come straight out of the sea and a beautiful natural environment, right? I think that's what really struck me when we moved there. I was 13, was this giant conifers, huge forests everywhere. And this incredible landscape that was a combination of these vertical mountains meeting the sea. It was beautiful.
How much will the local fauna encroach on your backyard while you're back?
Yeah, absolutely.
World?
I mean, I remember we lived in West Vancouver and we would get bears coming into the backyard and seeing cougars coming in, and you're right on the edge of the mountains, right on the edge of the wilderness.
Tell me about your family situation as you grew up.
My memory of growing up was one of a really happy childhood. I had two brothers and a little sister. I was the eldest, and we traveled everywhere. So I was one of the earliest things my dad always said to us. He said, boys, we don't have things, we do things. And what he loved was travel. He had this penchant for exotic places and crazy places. So when we were kids, we literally would go all over the place. Went to Panama when I was 10. We came to Australia when I was 13. I saw my first cricket match at the MCG. So that would have been back in the 70s. It was incredible because I remember the crowd was raucous. They were playing the West Indies and Viv Richards was batting and all these names I hadn't heard of, but now moving to Australia, I know that they're all legends. So, yeah, that was the kind of life that we led. Very privileged, I guess. Very lucky to be moving around. But my dad was also an incredibly flawed person.
He
was,
in what way?
He was a lifelong, very serious alcoholic, high-performing alcoholic. So one of those, I don't know if you've ever met them, but they can drink and drink and drink. And they eventually get to my dad. When he got really drunk, he got really abusive and very aggressive and nasty.
Right. So it was a Jekyll and Hyde type thing on the
drink? Because before that, he was the most erudite, generous, life of the party, tons of friends. Everybody loved him. And then he just would hit that point and he'd turn into somebody else. And then things got nasty and he would, you know, abuse my mom, frankly. I remember coming down the stairs when we were living in Toronto once and just hearing the screaming, the yelling, and just that vision of my dad having my mom backed into the corner and his hand raised. And I go, Dad! He turns and they both look at me, both of them terrified. It's crazy, right? My mom didn't want me to see it as much as my dad didn't want me to see it. And then I just turned and ran back upstairs. And I remember my mom coming up and crying. And so it was pretty harrowing to see the effect that alcohol can have on somebody, because we all knew that that's what it was, because he was controlled by it. And yet I remember a few times when I got older, I started to confront him when I started growing and getting bigger. And we had a few physical altercations. And when I got big enough to fight back, he sort of stopped trying to trying to dominate me in that way. And it wasn't until in my 20s that we actually started getting close. And I started trying to talk to him about it. Like, why do you do it? And he told me, I love drinking. I love it. It's fun. It's one of the best things in my life. So what do you do? And yet he was a high-performing guy. He was super, super successful. Made a lot of money. Met a lot of friends. Traveled all over the world. He was gone a lot.
People who have addictive personalities have all kinds of ways of rationalizing their addictions, though, don't they? But how much could he put away in a day or a night?
Pretty much his daily consumption would be at least 2 to 3 bottles of red wine and a full bottle of vodka a day, every day.
How did he survive that?
I don't know. He lived till 88.
And what kind of a job was he holding down in and around all this drinking?
By training, he was a lawyer. But he didn't practice for very long. I think sometime when I was before 10 years old, he would have stopped practicing law and started going into business, in inverted commas. Entrepreneurship was really all he ever talked about. You know, we just do business. But crazy things would happen. I remember one day we'd moved to Vancouver there. I might have been 15. And my brother woke up in the morning and he runs into the house and he goes, oh my God, everyone come outside to the driveway. There's a new car in the driveway. What? We walk out there and there was a beautiful black Ferrari 308 GT, 1975, with a big red bow on it and a card.
Was it for him or for your mother?
It was for him. What he said was that he was doing a deal with some American guys down in North Carolina and they'd gone out drinking and they'd made a bet that if they landed the deal, they were going to buy him a Ferrari. Then there it showed up.
Tell me what happened when you were 10 years old one day, which made you think, looking back, that your father may have had quite a shady past.
Oh, I'm pretty sure he was moving quite close to the edge for a long, long time. In the middle of the winter, I remember it would have been a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night, a school night. And the next morning, very early, my mom comes in, wakes us up, tells my brothers and I to dress in our little matching suits and ties, like we had these little matching suits as we did back in those years, and little coats. And she had all our 3 little bags packed for us, and we went to the airport. And we're saying, Mom, where are we going? It's school day. No, we're going to the airport. We get on a plane, and 8 hours later, we're in a little island in the Caribbean. And we'd just stay there until Mom said it was time to go back. And I was pretty sure he was either avoiding summons or avoiding being served or something. But that happened a few times without any explanation. And then my dad would show up on the island a few weeks later for a little while. And it was bizarre. And I never got an explanation from him. You know, I asked many, many times and I never got an explanation. I don't know if he's trying to protect me or my mom or himself.
What about his friends after he died? Did you ask any of his friends what they thought he might have been up to?
Yeah, actually, his best friend, Fred Ashworth, and I sat down with him the last time I was in Vancouver, so it would have been a year before he died. He was pretty frail. And we started talking openly about my dad. And I said, you know, my God, I can't believe how much he drank, for instance. And Fred says, oh, really? I thought he was just a casual drinker. And I said, no, Fred, he was a lifelong alcoholic. So he could hide things really, really well. Like he, even when he was very drunk, until he reached that point of being miserable and aggressive, you couldn't really tell. So to me, that was just a euphemism for somebody who could have a double life, who could put up and project what he thought others wanted to see while something else was going on.
So you had this childhood which was where adventure was normal, where there was violence in the house, heavy drinking. It sounds like your father was some kind of a macho role model in a way. Was that something that appealed to you when you were that age, to be that guy? Did you want to be him? Or it sounded like you hated him attacking your mother, for example. Did you have complicated feelings about all that?
Yeah, it was love-hate. Richard, 100%. It was a love-hate relationship. I loved my dad. I love him now. I'm proud to be able to talk about him now. I think he'd be really happy that I was telling the world about what a great guy he was. He was a great guy. Except when he wasn't. And you know, anyone who knows addiction knows that you're powerless over it and that you turn into somebody else. And he needed help. But that was a different era, right? Men of that generation, they drank hard. And it was what you had to do to be a man, I guess.
So what did you do once you left school?
So I've always wanted to be a writer since I was five. I had recognized that that was a difficult way to go. So I had gone into uni, I'd done my first year. And when I was about 18, I realized that I do want to try this writing thing. And so I quit my engineering courses and I said, okay, I'm a writer. And I started to it. So like my dad, I was drinking a lot, but I was determined to be the high-performing alcoholic that he was, although I didn't know that that's what I was at the time. And what I realized really quickly was that I could write, but I had nothing to say. I didn't know anything. I had no stories to tell. I didn't know anything. So I decided to just chuck it in and travel, right? So go get my degree in engineering and put my hand up to work in all the craziest places I could. The crazier, the better. The more dangerous, the better. So yeah, I went down to Texas and I roughnecked, which was crazy. Sort of one horse town in the middle of Texas, Brownwood, Texas, actually. And a culture that was so different than mine. I felt so displaced. None of the guys I worked with had finished high school. None of the guys I worked with had any sort of medical insurance. My rig leader had half his teeth were missing. Half of them were rotting in his head. They hurt like hell. I said, why don't you go to the dentist? Oh, I can't afford that. So he just took a shot of whiskey. I mean, and these guys were armed to the teeth. And it was Texas first, the South second, and then the United States. None of them had even been out of Texas. I guess the displacing part was the sheer insularity of that small town, roughnecking, hard drinking, hyper-armed Southern Texan world. It was crazy.
So that wasn't for you, that kind of world?
No.
You spent some time up in the Arctic Circle looking for gold. Tell me how you were actually looking for gold while you were up there.
So we would get helicoptered up from our fly camps, which were way out in the glaciated parts of Yukon and Alaska. And we would get dropped with tents and supplies for a week. And then we would have these very heavy handheld rock drills. And we would hike to locations that the geologists had identified on a previous trip. And we would drill holes. And we were carrying large amounts of dynamite. And we would load those holes with dynamite and, you know, set it all up, blasting caps and run the lines. And then, you know, blow up the mountainside.
What, looking for a gold seam?
Looking for gold, yeah. You expose the fresh rock, you find the rock that might have the gold in it, and then you have all the shattered material that you can then sample. You put it in bags, and the helicopter comes and takes the bags away, and then they assay it for gold. Or the helicopter would drop us in one location, but then we would radiate out to the pre-identified blasting positions carrying these 120-pound drills and 100 pounds of dynamite and a 12-gauge shotgun because there's grizzlies up there. And I never shot one. I don't want to because I love them, but to make sure that we're safe, yeah. So we had all this gear, and it was really, really hard work. But man, I'll tell you, was it ever fun? And the locations were just insanely beautiful. Glaciers everywhere. And
yeah, but after some time where you're actually blowing up large parts of that natural world, did that start to pull after a while?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, completely. I mean, there was part of me that my heart broke. There was no laws about fixing it up. We just leave these scarred areas of blasted, you know, rock, huge areas. Dynamite's an incredible thing. It's hard to realize how a small packet of, you know, small tube, but how much damage that can do to the natural world and to anything else.
In 1986, you spent some time in eastern Turkey, in Anatolia, somewhere near the border of Syria, in fact. What kind of work were you doing there?
I was doing oil and gas. So I was a geological engineer. That's what I did, right? That's why I was doing the gold exploration. And I got some work with the TPAO, the Turkish National Oil Company, and I went out there as a petrophysical engineer, and it was working on rigs, basically understanding the geology by looking at well logs and doing a lot of field work and stuff, so geological field mapping. So it was the same thing. It took me to these beautiful, unfrequented parts of Anatolia around the border. Now, this is the time of the Iran-Iraq war as well. Yeah. With the blockade, the only way the Iraqis could get their oil They couldn't get out through the Persian Gulf. So they tankered the oil through Turkey. And so there's a continuous 24-hour stream of these rickety old oil tankers that were plying the roads. And the roads were literally slick with crude oil, nonstop.
What kind of lifestyle were you following? Something like your father's at that point?
Well, yeah. I mean, in Turkey, you know, it's Muslim, but drinking is rife, you know, rakı and everything else. So, yeah, I was punishing my body. I wasn't looking after myself, but you know how it is in your 20s, you're bulletproof. But I was starting to have a bit of an awakening, and it was really not about me and my body, but it was about what this kind of extractive industry was doing to the world. The damage, the environmental damage that was being caused by the waste and the drilling and the warfare and the oil extraction. So I hadn't come to that realization yet, the personal one, but I had started to come to this realization that that is not what I wanted to do.
Who brought about that personal realization for you, though?
That was 100% my wife of 36 years, Heidi.
How did you meet Heidi?
I met her at Shell. So I had gone back to Canada after that. I had taken a job with Shell Oil in Canada, and I was doing oil exploration. So I hadn't got to the point yet where I had figured out how to decouple my professional direction from that extractive, damaging side of the world.
And what impact did she make on you when you first met her?
Our first date, she sat down and she looked amazing. She was an engineer herself, very accomplished woman. And she sat down across from me and she looked me in the eyes and she said, "I want you to know that I don't date for fun. I date because I want to find somebody that I want to live my life with. And there's a lot of things I want to do with my life, and here they are." And she went and listed all the things that she wanted to accomplish by what year. And I want to have kids. I want to have my first kid before I'm 30. And I want to marry somebody who's going to look after me and make enough money, because I want to raise my kids. I don't want anyone else raising them. And I want to travel the world. And I want to do things to help save the world.
And what were you thinking when she said that?
Half of me was saying, run away.
Yeah.
Because, you know, first date, she's already talking about wanting to get married and everything. And the other part was saying, you know, I'm yours. I love what I'm hearing.
So what did she put to you then?
She said, "You get three dates. Everyone only gets three dates. And if by the third date, I don't think that you have serious potential for being that person, you're out. So don't feel bad about it. It's not that you're not a nice guy. Just that's the deal."
What had to happen in the course of those three dates?
Well, those three dates, I had three dates to decide for myself whether that's what I wanted to pursue and whether those life goals were compatible with mine.
But your lifestyle wasn't compatible with it at that point,
no,
was it?
No.
So what had to change?
Basically, she told me that I had to stop. I was doing drugs by then as well. I had to stop doing drugs and I had to clean up and be the man that she wanted. And I decided that that's exactly what I was going to do, and I did it. And so she saved me. I was following my dad down that terrible dark hole that he had created for himself. He got too far in, right? I think there's a point in which you go too far in, the gravity is too strong.
So she pulled you out of that before the gravity got too strong?
Yeah, I think I pulled myself out of it under her influence, and she had a hand on the back of my collar as well.
How did she help you change the kind of work you wanted to do to get you out of that hole?
Yeah. So she was, from the moment I met her, she was a person who was really motivated by the environment. She loves animals, all animals. I mean, I'd never met a person who got really upset if I stood on an ant by accident, no kidding, or killed a spider. And she wasn't joking, right? It was very heartfelt. And that led me to really wonder about that attitude, which I'd never had. I didn't grow up that way. And I had always loved nature, but not in that very intense personal way. And what I learned from her was that we have a duty of custodianship. We're animals ourselves. She always reminds me of that. Don't forget, you're an animal as well. But we have this incredibly complex thing in our skulls that elevate us. And it gives us the responsibility of that, of having a custodianship over the natural world. And that's what I learned from her. And so we both decided to devote our lives together to protecting nature in whatever form that we could.
And what did that mean for you in concrete terms? Where did you, what did you change about yourself professionally at that
point? I immediately quit working in the oil industry and went to Imperial College in London and started and did a degree in water engineering. Because I think where I influenced her was that I think I convinced her to understand that it's actually the intersection between people and the environment where all the good things can happen, because that's the stress point, right? It's where those things meet. And so I wanted to devote myself to helping people who are living in we're all living in the environment, right? But helping people understand that we can find a point of coexistence. It's not a zero-sum game.
The World Bank then sent you to Africa, to Ghana in West Africa. What was the job there for you?
There I was working on water wells. And the problem in West Africa in that particular World Bank project was they had drilled thousands of water wells to provide villagers with clean water, largely to overcome waterborne disease, which is rampant in that part of the world, even now, particularly in surface water, so lakes and ponds and rivers and streams, which traditionally the Africans would use for their water supply for drinking and cooking and everything else. And one of the particularly horrible diseases called something called guinea worm.
What is that? It's a kind of parasite, is it?
Yeah. It's a parasite. So the parasite is present in standing surface water. It actually enters through your skin. So all you have to do is touch the water.
Oh, you don't need to drink it?
No. It just splashes on your hand, or if you're wading through it, or kids splashing around in the water.
So it's super tiny at that, that stage.
Yeah, and it literally swims through your skin. You know what? It's so small, it pierces that skin barrier.
And what's it do once it gets inside?
Once it gets inside, it starts to grow and consume, gets nutrients from you. And the particularly nasty part is that the female guinea worm completes the cycle, the life cycle, by growing very big and very fertile. We're talking about when fully formed, more than a meter long.
Oh, my God.
And what it does, it finds the long bones in your body, so your leg bones in particular, and it cozies up to those long bones in your legs, and she starts to move down towards your ankle. And what she's doing is she's moving her sex organ through gravity along the sheaths of your long bones to eventually start to protrude just around your ankles. And when she's ready, she'll lay her eggs, and you'll get a blister there, and the blister will burst on contact with water, of course.
And more parasite babies are released into the water, and then they go into
and the life cycle is complete. And then her little tail is sticking out of your leg. Once she's done that, she's committed, she has to come out. And you'll see these little kids wandering around with matchsticks, and they just wind the worm up as she comes out. But it takes a long time. It takes weeks. And so they just wind her up as she comes out. You can't pull it. If you do, you break, you get infected, you can die really easily. So you just have to let her come out.
So this is why clean water then, it's critical?
Absolutely critical. So the problem was that these wells are subject to fouling with minerals, particularly iron, and it just blocks them up and they don't work. So I was there studying, you know, how do you fix that? How do you rehabilitate the wells? I was going all over Ghana and the Ivory Coast into some of the tiniest villages. We had a rig and we would clean out the wells and make them operational again. It was incredible. But there was no working phone system. I had met Heidi. We had done the 3 dates. I'd got through to the point where I'd asked her to marry me and she said yes. And we had decided to elope, partially because she came from a very large family and her dad hated weddings and told her when she was 15 that he'd give her $5,000 if she eloped.
He said, I'll give you $5,000 if you elope, because that the cost saving factor there, like $5,000 is nothing compared to what the $100,000 he would perhaps spend having to feed and provide for all the relatives otherwise.
Absolutely.
That's a very smart move.
So there was no working phone system. So I phoned her twice in the time I was there. There was a Dutch freighter in Takoradi Harbor, and the German guy I was working with, the senior guy, said, okay, well, we can call it. Because I said, I have to call her because it's 2 weeks until the appointed time. If I send a letter now, it won't get there for 3 weeks. I really need to talk to her, make sure she's coming, because we'd arranged a date. I said, are you still coming? over. She goes, yeah. I said, you have to say over. Yeah, over. I'm coming. And that was it.
So you had your wedding in Ghana then?
Yeah. So we did a legal wedding with the Justice of the Peace. I just had my rig crew as the witnesses. And we signed this very elaborate Ghanaian wedding certificate. And then one of the villages where I'd spent a lot of time had invited us to come up to Ghana. I said, look, I'm getting married very soon. Okay, well then, you have to bring her. You have to bring her back. And so they gave us a traditional African wedding ceremony. For the first 2 days before the ceremony, we had to be separated. So Heidi went with the women. They taught her how to cook fufu, you know, pounding the fufu. They taught her how to cook and they bathed her and they dressed her up like an African lady with the cloths, you know, the big headdresses and everything else.
Oh, how lovely. How kind. What about you? What did you do?
What do blokes do? We went out and collected palm wine and sat around and drank.
And you're going, basically. But you don't understand. This is the man my wife's trying not to get me to be. And,
yeah, right. Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. I've been very good since then overall, Richard.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can find more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app.
Well, you also spend a lot of time working in Yemen, right at the bottom of the Arabian Peninsula there as well. And you've written about it in your novels as well. How did that place affect you when you went to Yemen, to Sana'a, the capital there?
Yemen is a place where if you still want to see Arabia as it was 250 years ago, that's where you can go. But it's also, it's incredibly beautiful. The people are amazing, so hospitable. But it's a very, very fraught place to be. There's conflict. It's the heaviest, most heavily armed place in the world. And it affected me deeply because I came face to face again with some things that were just beyond comprehension in terms of damage that people can willingly do to others.
It seems to be a place that's stuck in the medieval world in some ways. It was able to sort of somehow not join the modern world for a very, very long time. Is that what you saw while you were there?
That's exactly what I saw, and it's still like that. Part of the reason is that it's not really a functioning country as we understand it. It's really just a series of fiefdoms, of tribal areas, each with its own prince, and each prince has literally his own army as such, and own armed groups, and they just pledge their forces to the president. So President Saleh back then, you know, he was the president, but really he just had a bunch of princes who were backing him up. And it can all unravel very, very quickly.
There's been a civil war there for a long time now. Yes. Was it there? Was it raging while you were there?
So I was there in 94. I'd been working there in the early 90s. And in 94, when I was there, one of the many civil wars broke out. I remember Scuds falling on Sana'a. That's a pretty scary feeling. Just realizing that you have absolutely nothing to do other than sit there and wait for it to either happen or not happen. Hearing those booms reverberating across that ancient city. And it was pretty scary. I think one of the last Westerners to get out of there before it really started going haywire.
So there is all that violence. But on the other hand, there's still the kind of fabulousness of the traditional life that's still being served in the place there. I know this because a friend of mine who went there in the 90s managed to sit in on a cut-eating ceremony where they were eating those leaves that are sort of, I don't know, they've got something in them. It's not caffeine, or it might be caffeine, I don't know, but it's you get a buzz from it. Did you do that while you were in Sana'a?
Oh, yeah, you have to. Because I worked all over Yemen, and so I did cut shoes all over Yemen. And it's a mild amphetamine is the best way I can describe it. So it's a big-time upper. It keeps you awake.
Like for how long in your case?
Well, after the first cut chew I did, which is about 6 hours, a 6 hour chew, you get this huge ball in your cheek. You'll see people walking around like they got a tennis ball in their cheek. And yeah, I didn't sleep for 48 hours, two whole nights. God. And I love my sleep. I felt worse than I think I've ever felt in my life.
It's kind of hard to explain, but aside from this violence, there's also this intense civility as well, isn't there? And this intense tradition of hospitality. Did you receive that kind of hospitality?
Everywhere I went. I mean, arguably, you know, a Westerner traveling around pretty much on his own around different parts of Yemen, you might feel fairly exposed or what have you, but they are incredibly hospitable. So once you're with them, the code is that they'll protect you with their lives. So that's an amazing thing. And the other thing that struck me, Richard, is that ultimate fatalism that comes with being a devout Muslim in that almost medieval sense. It's written. It's all up to Allah. I have to follow the Quran, and if I do, I will live, you know, in paradise. And it was all Bukhara, inshallah. Tomorrow, God willing.
So you moved to Australia, then in 2017, you took up a role as the CEO of the Australian Institute of Marine Science. Was this the first time you'd seen the Great Barrier Reef?
No. When I was 13, we came to Australia. That's when I saw the cricket match. We also did a little trip out to the Whitsundays and went below the waves and saw some of the most... It was amazing seeing that coral, those coral gardens and the fish. And
yeah, I've only been out there once, but I've never forgotten it. It's completely sublime. Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's like nothing in the, you know, there's no experience like it, I think, on planet Earth. It was amazing.
To be submerged and have fish above and all around you and below you, beautiful, kind of luminous fish, is heavenly.
I think it's more than that. For me, there's almost a spiritual side of things. So as this was building inside me, this deep need to understand my purpose and to start to feel that I was getting close to understanding my purpose for life, that kind of emotional experience. I'm not religious. That's as close as for me as it gets.
So when did you begin to realize that the mighty Great Barrier Reef was not invincible?
I'm not a marine scientist. When I got that job, I walked right into the back-to-back bleaching events of 2016 and 2017, which were unprecedented. Your listeners may remember that in 2016, the northern third of the reef lost 80% of its hard coral cover. And then the year after, the central part of the reef got smashed and had a similar effect. So that in those two events, by all reckoning, the reef lost half of its coral and dead, not just bleached, but dead, died, mortality. And that's what I landed in when I took that job.
Then is that job then to manage the slow death of the Great Barrier Reef?
Well, this is the question, right? This is not just the question for AIMS, the Australian Institute of Marine Science,
it's
or for me,
for the whole world and Australia in particular.
For all of us, yeah. Are we just, when we're doing all that science on the reef, when we're watching it, when we're monitoring it, are we just documenting the decline and disappearance of an ecosystem? Is that all we're doing? Just documenting it? Studying it? Recording its death for posterity? Or are we using that to actually create the courage in ourselves to do something about it?
So when you were asked to take on this job, did you think twice about it?
I was writing full-time at that point. I'd waited my whole life to write full-time. I'd left CSIRO with the goal to write full-time. And so I was weighing that life of complete self-indulgence up against the opportunity to do something that I really cared about for my adopted country that had let me in and let me become a citizen and had asked me to do something that mattered to the country. So it wasn't a very hard decision. It was the best job I've ever done.
What satisfaction were you able to get from that job under these circumstances?
I think that for me, the knowledge that, you know, I think for everybody, it's just the knowledge that you're doing what you can, right? No one person is going to be the answer. No one person is going to pull the world out of the fire, solve climate change. But if you can do your piece and you can stand up, you can hold your head high, and you can hopefully inspire others. So I think trying to inspire others has been the part that has given me the most satisfaction.
So did you see your job as someone, apart from being managing an organization that has to monitor the reef, but also to be the reef's champion?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, go to Senate estimates and talk to politicians and leaders of the country and look them in the eyes and tell them the truth about what's going on and dispel the false hope, the messages of false hope that are out there. Try to set that record straight and make sure that people understand what's actually going on. And
was all the tourism industry based around the reef as well? Was there a lack of willingness to want to know?
Yeah, I think there's so much money tied up in the reef that people are worried that if you paint a picture that it's all over or that it's imminently over, people will stop coming and the money will dry up.
So what can you ask for in that role? What kind of is really the problem, the slowly warming oceans? And with that, then are you just becoming another voice then calling for faster action on climate change and carbon reduction?
Essentially, yes. I mean, frankly, by far the greatest threat to the reef now is climate change. As the oceans warm, the risk of bleaching and coral mortality gets higher and higher. We went through one this summer again, 2024. Serious mass bleaching causing coral death. We won't know for a couple months how bad it gets, but it's pretty bad. So that's the answer. We have to deal with that. We have to find the courage to deal with climate change.
And yet you say you're an optimist.
I am.
What makes you optimistic?
Anyone under 35, frankly. There's no one under 35 that doesn't get this. And as they come into power and exert more influence, I think things will change. The question is, will it change fast enough?
How about the traditional owners, the Aboriginal people of that part of the world around the reef? Did you consult with them while you were doing your work?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the things that at AIMS I'm most proud of that we did, is that when I was there, we really worked hard to not only consult with traditional owners, but to bring them into the decision-making process from the beginning. We're the first federal Commonwealth agency to enshrine FPIC, free, prior, and informed consent, as a requirement for every single AIMS project. So that means that we don't just tell you we're coming to do something on your sea country. We're going to ask you permission. Even though we have legal permission, we don't have cultural permission until you tell us to. And inherent is that they might say no.
And if they did say no?
Then we don't go.
Is this what you mean when you talk about the intersection of people with the environment working in those areas?
Exactly. That's one of the key things, whether you're in Yemen or in Torres Strait, the thing, it's the same, right? There are people that depend on and have lived in harmony with those ecosystems for a long, long, long time. And we need to get back to finding that balance.
Did you ever get to talk to your dad about the kind of work you were doing?
I did. I absolutely did. He's a question asker. Like you. He loved asking questions. So that was part of the reason I think that you could never ask him one. But he always wanted to know what I was doing, what work I was doing, he loved business. So it was like, oh, are you making money? Are you bringing in money? He liked that side of things. But over time, he got more and more interested in the subject matter, right? The environment, what's going on with the planet, etc. He never believed in climate change until a lot later in his life. And he and I used to fight about it. And then, you know, later on in his life, he started to understand. He's a lawyer. He was smart and rational. And yeah, he got there.
So you started having more conversations with this very hard-drinking, hard-living father of yours as he got older?
Yeah. As he got older, he and my mom divorced. He started going out with a woman who was my age. So, you know, quite a bit younger. And he got better. He got a little bit better, started drinking a little bit less. So maybe a bottle and a half of red wine less, still loved the vodka. And it was enough that we could start to really talk more about, mostly about me. He loved talking about what I was doing. And that gave me an opening to start to try to work on his understanding of what was really going on in the world. And I figured if I could get him across the line, I could get anyone across the line.
One thing I've found is that, and this is true of men in particular, I think, that don't want to talk about their lives, what's been going on in their lives. Once they get over the speed bump of 80, suddenly they're willing to talk. Did he start telling you any stories about this shady life he'd led once he got over the 80-year-old speed bump?
He did. One of the, not many, but one that he told me in great detail was set in Cuba just after the revolution.
Just after Castro took over.
Just after Castro took over. And he and a bunch of business partners had been doing a series of deals with the Batista regime, so before the revolution, and had put a lot of time and money into deals. Now, that was all he would tell them.
The mafia was all over those business deals
they were.
In Cuba.
And he was also going to Russia a lot at the time. Yeah. So late 50s, right? Cuban Missile Crisis, right around then. He'd gone into Russia at least 3 or 4 times through Sweden. I know that for a fact. So anyway,
what was he doing in Cuba?
So we don't. I don't know. Deals. That's all he told me, Richard. He was doing, deals.
But I thought when Castro took over, that was the end of that. The mafia were kicked out, and that's. I think that's true, isn't it? But nonetheless, what was he doing there post-revolutionary?
Well,
Cuba?
The thing was is that when the revolution happened, their deals, who were with the people who were running the country before, right, all the rich Cubans.
Who'd fled to Miami.
Who had fled to Miami, yeah. Or been put up against the wall and shot. They were left with no return. So they decided to hire a private jet. They flew from Toronto to Havana, and they landed in Havana.
Oh, he could do that because he was Canadian.
Because he was Canadian.
Right, right. So he lands in... So your Canadian father lands in Castro's Cuba. This is 1959-60 or something, is it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, what happens then?
And basically they land, and it's, of course, mayhem, right? Because right after the revolution, a few weeks, everything's mayhem, and nobody knows who they are. A truck comes with this colonel in the... revolution, the new revolutionary army, right? I'm sure it was anybody. You can be a colonel. And they're told to get in the truck. And there's all these armed guards with machine guns and stuff, AK-47s. And his dad told me, he said, we're thinking, okay, we're going to be shot, right, basically. And anyway, they're taken to some administrative building and they state their case. Like, we've got all this invested. You still want the goods, right? And they're partly delivered. We can continue to deliver them. We want to get some payment. But all of our contacts are gone or in jail or shot or what have you. And so they're told to wait. And they wait in this waiting room for half a day. And then finally the colonel comes back and they're told to get back in the truck. And they're driven through Havana thinking that, again, that the worst is going to happen. And they end up at this huge warehouse. And the truck stops. They jump out of the back. The colonel opens the door to the warehouse, and it's like the Indiana Jones, you know, at the end of the first Indiana Jones movie. And he basically says, you have 45 minutes. You can take anything you want out of this warehouse. It's got to fit in the back of this truck. And then you're going straight to the airport, and then you can load it onto your plane, and you can get, and you can, you know what, off, right?
And what was in this warehouse?
It was everything that the revolutionaries had confiscated from all of the incredibly rich Cubans, right? The upper elite Cuban.
So we're talking paintings, statues.
Silverware, furs, women's clothing, everything, right? Everything you can imagine. And so they're running through this warehouse. They go, oh my God, I got a Picasso. Oh, look at this silverware set, furs. It was mayhem. They just piled everything in a big pile behind the truck. And the colonel's sitting there tapping his watch saying, you know, you don't have long left. And it's all sitting there in a big pile. And they go, my God, we've got to get this onto the truck. So the guy says, oh, I saw a carpet back there. My dad's name was Murray. Come and help me carry this carpet. We'll unroll it. We'll chuck everything in, right? Roll it up and chuck it in the back of the truck. So they do. And they drive him to the airport. They stuff this. They stuff this carpet into the plane.
The world's biggest carpet
into
bag.
Into the plane, not into the cargo hold, into the actual passenger compartment, because that's the only place it would fit. They clamber over it, sit in their seats, they fly back to Toronto. So in the end, my dad told me that they sold all everything. They got most of the money was for the women's clothes. That's where we got most of the money. Picasso turned out to be a fake, et cetera, et cetera. and they got 10 cents on the dollar.
Oh, man. That's amazing. That's got to be one of the shonkiest stories I've ever heard on the show. And it's deliciously shonky. But it's like a James Ellroy novel or something. So this is kind of fantasy that America in the late 50s, 60s was this naive, happy, simple place, picket fences and all, and what have you. When in fact, it sounds like your dad, despite being Canadian, this is a guy who went into Russia several times, as you say. Was that kind of really, really strange nexus between the CIA, the mafia, revolutionary Cuba. That sounds kind of interesting. But it's amazing he told you that story.
Well, there's a final element to it. A year later, the carpet was rolled up in one of his friend's garages, and a guy was visiting, and he said, he was looking around at the guy's new sports car. He said, "What's that carpet over there?" He said, "I don't know. We just told him the story." He said, he walks over, he looks at it, he goes, "Oh my God, this is like a 14th century French tapestry, not a Bayeux tapestry, but that thing was worth millions. It was worth more than everything else that they pulled out of there." And in the end, they ended up making quite a bit of money just selling that one carpet. So it's amazing the way things work out. It's better to be lucky than smart.
He's no longer with us, your father.
No.
Your extraordinary father. What were the circumstances of his death?
He died very predictably of liver and kidney failure. During COVID, I was here. I couldn't say goodbye to him. My brother was with him. He's a terrible patient. He was driving the hospital crazy. He was only there for a few days. Didn't last long. I just said goodbye to him. Last thing I said to him was, all I ever wanted was you to be proud of me. And he said he was. And I said goodbye, and that was it.
Did he ever talk to you about his struggles with alcohol, insofar that it was a struggle for him?
No. No. The only thing he ever told me was that he loved drinking and that he could stop any time he wanted. It was a cliche. You know, I've stopped tons of times, hundreds of times, but I love it, so I don't ever want to stop completely.
So it sounds like he was a big influence on what you wanted to be and what you didn't want to be at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. There's that duality was always present. I think I wanted to be the provider and the care and the protector that he was, and I wanted to work hard and be successful like he was. He was driven to be successful, and he loved successful, interesting people. And all of those things, I wanted to be all those things, but I also didn't want to be all the really terrible, abusive, self-abusive parts of his persona.
And now you're a full-time writer.
I am.
That kind of unstructured life where you don't show up at a job and you generate all your own work. How are you liking the life?
I'm absolutely loving it. I waited my whole life to do it. Finally get to do it. Got a lot more years behind me than ahead of me, so it's the right time. I'm determined to do it. And I think just the joy of being able to wake up every morning and write is I feel very privileged to be able to do that.
Paul, it's been my privilege to speak with you, sir. It's been amazingly enjoyable. I love this wild ride we've been on. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Richard, for having me on the show.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
If you enjoy riveting real-life stories, then you'll love the latest episode of Background Briefing's new series, Notorious. Meet a person once described as one of Australia's most hated people, at least on social media.
I was going through my tagged photos on Instagram. Fat, disgusting stain on the world, definitely top reality villain of our time, and that's not a good thing.
Olivia Fraser was cast as a villain on the popular reality TV show Married at First Sight. But was she really the bad guy?
They made me look like a criminal on the biggest show in Australia, and I didn't sign up to be framed as a criminal.
What happens when the truth gets in the way of good television? Join me, Linton Besser, for Notorious, a special series by Background Briefing about people we know for reasons they'd rather forget. Search for Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app.